The first reading this morning comes from the beloved Kentucky poet and essayist Wendell Berry, beloved of many people in this congregation. He's got provocative and completely delicious titles for some of his books, including this one, Sex, Economy, Freedom, and Community.
It makes no sense to equate equality with freedom. The two concepts must be joined precisely and within strict limits if their association is to make any sense at all. Equality, in certain circumstances, is anything but free. If we have equality and nothing else, no compassion, no magnanimity, no courtesy, no sense of mutual obligation and dependence, no imagination, then power and wealth will have their way. Brutality will rule. A general and indiscriminate egalitarianism is a free market culture, which, like free market economics, tends towards a general uniformity. Egalitarianism can be a way of ignoring the reality of significant differences. If I merely tolerate my neighbors on the assumption that all of us are equal, that means I can take no interest in the question of right and wrong. It means I am denying the community the use of my intelligence and judgment. It means that I am not prepared to defer to those whose abilities are superior to mine, or help those whose conditions are worse. It means I can be as self-centered as I please. In order to survive, a plurality of true communities would require not egalitarianism, but knowledge and understanding of the necessity of local differences and respect. Respect, I think, also implies imagination, the ability to see one another across our inevitable differences as living souls.
The second reading comes from Juanita Brown's book, The World Cafe, a book I've quoted favorably before. It was written just 4 years ago, and it was illustrated by my good friend Kevin Woodson, who many of you met last year when he was here for Thanksgiving and decorated the chancel with his little figures. Contribution has a different tone and feeling than individual participation. Important as it is, the focus on individual participation can lead to an overemphasis on the I. I'm voicing my opinions. I'm speaking up. The philosopher John Dewey, in a 1937 speech, Democracy is a Way of Life, commented, "While what we call intelligence can be distributed in unequal amounts, it is the democratic faith that it is sufficiently general so that each individual has something to contribute, whose value can be assessed only as it enters into the final pooled intelligence constituted by the contributions of all." Now, I could tell you that I miss living by the sea now that I live in Ohio and not in California, but that would be an exaggeration. I worked out there just as much as I work here. I had an equally engaging social life, and so I only used to get to the shore about twice a year, if I was lucky. Still, even though I didn't see it very often, I do love the sea. I love the ocean. I love the beach. Not to sun myself, mind you, but to walk the shiny sand and pick up sand dollars just as the evening sun turns everything into roses. So I want to begin my sermon this morning with a beach story, a tale of the sea. I've told this story before privately. Some of you may have heard it. But it's time to tell it again in a larger venue because there's a good insight, I think, hidden within it. Almost 20 years ago, I served as a chaplain, a week-long chaplain, at a Unitarian Universalist conference out at Ferry Beach in Maine along Saco Bay, sometimes pronounced Saco Bay, which itself is part of the Great Bay of Fundy. I led services in their famous Chapel in the Woods, counseled individuals as we strolled down the beach, and led sung graces before supper. It's the place, in fact, from which the song we sang before the silence, "I Brought My Spirit to the Sea," actually comes from and what it refers to, although they sing it to a different melody. One hot day, a man I did not know at all asked me if I could conduct a ceremony to scatter the ashes of his late partner in life, ashes which he had brought with him to the conference. I said, "Yes, of course I can do that. And naturally, you'll have to talk to me a little bit so I can get to know you and you can tell me something about the person who died." So he came to talk to me. And it turned out that his late partner's life was quite a sad one, filled with drugs and drinking and violence. But his surviving spouse had grown through this tough relationship, and so he assured me he wanted the fellow to be remembered as a whole human being, if a very sad human being. Moved by his confession, I agreed to do the ceremony. And because of the heat of the day, I agreed to do it just before dark, when it was cooler. So he gathered about 30 people from the conference on the beach in support. None of these people knew who this man was either, or his late partner's life. Now, it was exactly at sunset, and the dark closed around us very fast. By candlelight, I read some poetry. Then talked about the man's very sad life and lifted up the whole person as his partner had asked. And then, as planned, I was handed the box in which the ashes were kept. I was to wade out into the water by myself and scatter the ashes in the water when I had reached sufficient depth to do so, and I was wearing cutoffs. Before I ventured forth, I taught the people on the beach the song, "I Know This Rose Will Open," and they sang it as they waded into Saco Bay. Turns out I really didn't know what I was doing. I waded, and I waded, and I waded, and I waded, and the water turned out to be ridiculously shallow. It wasn't even covering the tops of my feet. I had already walked 5 full minutes out into the sea. Later, I learned that the tides in this area are among the most spectacular in the world, which explained the situation, but I didn't know that then. Soon, I was so far into the sea, I couldn't even hear them singing on the beach anymore. It felt like I had waited for miles. I began to fear that the lights I could see in the distance were the lights of Calais in France. I kept trudging. Finally, the water rose to cover my ankles, And I thought with great relief, well, deep enough. So I opened the box, and even by the wan starlight, I could see that the ashes were wrapped in thick plastic and secured by packing tape, just as the funeral home had prepared them. I was holding a plastic football filled with someone's ashes, and I was in shorts, wearing a t-shirt, standing in water just barely splashing over my ankles in the middle of absolute darkness, and I had no knife. I started to laugh. It was completely absurd. And I knew there could be only very few ways to cut through plastic without a knife, most of which involved my teeth. Yet in despair, I knew that there was no other solution. So, realizing that I would probably get a mouthful of ash, I bit open the plastic, poured the rest of the ash out into the sea, and then washing my mouth off with the salty seawater, I waded back to shore, hoping I was at least going in the right direction. I found the whole crew of 30 on the beach, sitting down by this time, waiting for me and wondering if it was time to call the Coast Guard. We laughed a bit about the shallowness of the bay and my experience about having to walk out so far, and then we retired and went back to our individual tents or rooms. Now, I never told the guy about the plastic in the box. I was upset, of course. I was actually quite angry that he gave me the box unprepared, had not warned me, with the bag sealed up tight like that. I was kind of riled about it. But then it struck me. How was he supposed to know? Really? It's not like most of us pick up boxes of ashes 5 times a week. It's not like anyone would have taken him aside and told him. It's not like knowledge pops into our heads like magic. Skills rise up within us by sorcery. It's not like we can learn to play the piano without practicing, learn to dance without being taught somehow, learn French without taking classes or using Rosetta Stone on our computers faithfully. And it's not like we can chair committees, organize task forces, negotiate complex systems, and run meetings without training either. There is no gene or chromosome I know which grants automatic leadership ability and skill. And so over the years, I've thought about the shallows I've often stood in, trying to do something important, but sometimes only getting frustrated by my expectations of other people not being met, not just in Saco Bay, but in my shallow version of democracy that dogs my tracks sometimes and dogs the tracks of many religious liberals in their congregations. There is a joke, a relatively rueful one, often told by people in smaller Unitarian Universalist congregations. The joke goes like this. Oh, look, there's a visitor at the greeter stand. We should go up and introduce ourselves. After all, within 2 weeks, she'll be the president of the congregation. The joke is trying to make several things clear. One, that committees in smaller congregations almost always go begging for members, since everyone is already doing too many things as it is. New visitors are often not seen as guests or seekers that might enrich the community, but literally as new blood to keep the place running smoothly and to keep burnout to a minimum. These poor new visitors, why would they ever come back if they thought that? But two, the joke is trying to make clear that any definition of democracy which posits that it's simply your turn to hold office, regardless of training, skills, or suitability, is a very shallow definition indeed. I agree, and so does Wendell Berry. It makes no sense to equate equality with freedom, he asserts boldly. Equality in certain circumstances is anything but free. If we have equality and nothing else, no compassion, no magnanimity, no simple courtesy, no sense of mutual obligation and dependence, no imagination, then power and wealth will have their way and brutality will rule. A lot of strong words in that short paragraph. Oh, compassion is an easy word for most of us. Magnanimity, too, although most of us would probably just say goodwill. But the words mutual obligation and dependence may prove harder for many of us, I think, because we have often indeed conflated freedom with equality. Words like obligation and dependence make many progressive people nervous. They are words that might feel like a spiritual straitjacket to some of us, perhaps like the unbending words of a rigid creed. And yet there are no examples that I can think of in all of human history, in any culture around the world, of societies existing without both mutual obligation and mutual dependence, or what we would now call interdependence. Democracy is not about our sameness, you see. It's about our difference, our differences. It's about our distinct gifts, which we hopefully both note and take joy in cultivating. Democracy is about you being able to do things I simply can't imagine doing for myself, and me doing things that you find startling. Not everyone can stand up here in the pulpit to make something so simple as an announcement, let alone offer a sermon. I have certainly had people over the years tell me in no uncertain terms, they're not just joking, that they would rather die, D-I-E, than do a reading up here or even give an announcement. The very real fear that some folks express about public speaking may not even be something they can alleviate with a few sessions of the Toastmasters organization, however helpful they may be. On the other hand, don't bother to ask me to advise you about gardening, because your rose will not ever open again if I get my hands on it. Or don't ask me to repair your computer, sew a stole, or keep my desk free of Leaning Tower of Pisa piles. It's just not likely to happen. Oh, I suppose I could learn to sew if I really tried hard enough. My friend Stefan made all of his own clothes all of his life, so I know it can be learned. But sewing is not really what grabs me. Early on, I recognized that my more native gifts were more verbal, more in the area of design and composition. And these are the gifts that I have trained and honed and studied over the years. These are the reasons why I went to seminary and take continuing education classes. And now these are my contributions to this religious community, which claims, in its principles, democratic methods for itself. The contributions we individually offer, the I to the we, help make this congregation stronger, more vital, and more rooted, all of which helps it to be of service to the larger community, all of which helps it to be a witness in the larger world. But my contribution is just my contribution. Yours will be different from mine, many of you, most of you. Some of you, in fact, will not die if you come up here to speak and act as easy in this pulpit as I appear to be. And don't for a moment think it's not just an appearance. I still get nervous, too, before I walk up into this thing. I've just learned not to let my nerves govern me. But many of you are far superior to me in certain aspects of leadership and organization and skill. And I have learned it's wiser to defer to you in many matters, just as Wendell Berry suggests. Oops, there it goes again, that Wendell Berry using words that make religious progressives really uncomfortable. Superior and defer. But to deny that in some areas we are superior to each other and in some inferior means to say that we must all have absolutely equal gifts, equal opportunities, equal encouragement, and equal self-understanding. And for this, I can find no evidence whatsoever, either in my experience or in any of my studies over 35 years. There is no shame if I defer to others. And please, I'm not referring to any of the talking heads who use words like superior and defer to refer to race, gender, sexual identity, or anything else like that. I have no respect whatsoever for people who proclaim such claims. But let me put it this way. I am not ashamed to be unable to press 350 pounds like my friend Jimmy, the bodybuilder, can. I am not ashamed I can't run the New York Marathon like my friend Doug did last weekend. They are superior to me in athletic ability. And I am not ashamed to be ignorant of Portuguese, unlike my friends Richard and Lucas. Lucas speaks it because he grew up near Brasilia and learned it from his mother. Richard, because he studied it in school. I was neither raised in Brazil, nor did I study Portuguese at the university, so I defer to their incredible skills. But please note, that does not make me unequal to them in dignity and worth. That basic equality is simply inherent in all of us because of the grace of simply being born. The gifts that differentiate us, however, are noted that cultivated, practiced, taught, and learned. This is why our congregation's leadership training will soon be featured in a Unitarian Universalist publication, our Soup Service and Leadership series that you can sign up for. There's a poster outside. It's been going on for a couple of years, and we're actually somewhat known for that. Did you know that? I hope you see how democracy, this month's theme word, is not a shallow idea, but a deep one, a demanding one. It's not the automatic gift of our ancestors, but something we create together right now by contributing our gifts together, as Juanita Brown reminded us, to deepen our community and strengthen its power to witness and bring social healing. Note, not all gifts may appear equally useful to the community. That's true. If your strength is the ability to speak the Moldovan language, I salute you. But Moldovan is not something that proves very useful around here. As Dewey put it, our contributions need to be assessed as they enter into the final pooled intelligence constituted by the contributions of all. But compassion, imagination, and a sense of mutual obligation keep that assessment from being some sort of judgment of human worth. It is not at all. And although John Dewey and Wendell Berry and Juanita Brown are indeed great minds and provocative thinkers, their contributions are matched by the ancient Chinese folktale as retold by Kathy Tucker and told so beautifully by Bev Davis this morning. Remember, during a time of crisis, the seven sisters each contribute their skill, as unique as it is, to the solving of an emergency. And in the end, by being attentive to and supporting and rejoicing in each other's differences, and by even reverencing them, they are also thereby able to be attentive to the dragon who has been tormenting them, noticing his differences from them, noting that his hunger and loneliness can be addressed too, his native strength appreciated. This is a deep story. There is nothing shallow about it. It is not at all like the story I told you at the beginning of the sermon, the one of a man trying to accomplish something significant by wading in the dark through a shallow, shallow sea and then getting angry that no one warned him of the frustrations of doing such a thing. No, the Chinese folktale of the Seven Sisters is different. It expresses democratic principles for what they are: deep, rich, instructive, and very demanding. There is nothing shallow about them. Our differences are not just delightful, therefore. They are vitally important. We cannot do this without each other. So now I know why I didn't get angry at that poor man who had given me a box of sealed ashes, which I had to open with my reluctant teeth. Somehow I intuited the deepest part of me intuited that it was simply shallow of me to expect him to know such things automatically. My anger was a form of arrogance that expected someone to know something, in fact, he would not be likely to know by himself. And I learned that there is no place in a democratic society for such arrogance or such anger. There is no place in a democratic society for holding anyone to expectations we have not first cleared with them, even as we offer our encouragement to them. I told you the story of my walk in ridiculously shallow waters with the box full of ashes at the beginning of this sermon. I told you that this story taught me that you can walk a long, long way in the dark, in the shallows, and still not get to accomplish what you wanted in the way that you had imagined. I told you I never told this story to the man who had given me the ashes in the first place. But I did tell the story. I told it to my music director at the time, Mary Gregolia, who wrote the song that we sang at the beginning of this service, "I Know This Rose Will Open." She didn't stay my music director for long. She left when she heard the call to ministry. Eventually, she was ordained and chosen to serve a church in the Cleveland area. One Sunday, she happened to tell the story I told her as part of the Sunday sermon. The congregation enjoyed the service very much, but one man burst out laughing at the end of the story. He was one of the visitors who had come in that day, and it was his first time in one of our churches, although he confessed to having gone to Unitarian Universalist camps before. Guess who it was? The man who had given me the box of ashes in the first place. It was his story being told on that Sunday morning. But maybe, if you were listening carefully, you may have heard a bit of your story being told here this morning as well.